Good morning, everybody. I'm certainly glad. What I say is, you know, use your schedule. How many of you have job schedulers that you use? You know, you can set up your job schedulers where they put some parameters, say big file, small file, streaming, you know, pick some easy words and let that sit there and pick for them and put it where it is. And if they pick wrong, they will quickly learn where it needs to be. Of course, there's also these cases where the people start with reading millions of small files, aggregate them into a big file, so you need to. There's a two-day tutorial I do on high-performance storage systems that I recently delivered at Brown University. And one of the people there recommended me to Amy Rich, who's coordinating the invited talks this year, and invited me for this opportunity here this morning. And so what I want to do is take my presentation will be a very technically focused one. Since I do get paid by IBM, you'll apparently, from time to time, you'll see IBM references here and there, but it is more coincidental. The focus this morning is supposed to be technical. And how many of you, by the way, are working with petabyte-sized file systems? Oh, there's a number of hands going up. I know until very recently they seemed very unusual, and last year I know I designed two or three of them, and this year I have at least 10 or 15 that I've already designed this year. The petabyte size, which I remember, at supercomputing, I happened to run the storage challenge, and I was also worked on the store cloud challenge, and at SC05, the goal was to put, SC04, the goal was to put a petabyte of spinning disk in one place on the floor. And that just seemed unthinkable, and today I saw at least 20 hands go up or 10 hands go up with petabyte-sized storage systems. These are no longer a thing of the future. They are coming into line. And by the way, the thing that comes after peta is exabytes. Nobody's built one that big yet that I know of. Okay, why am I not? Okay, here we go. Now, one of the problems that you have when building a petabyte-sized storage system like this is usually associated with a large cluster of computing. And so the center manager is focusing on all kinds of things like CPU architecture, memory architecture, bus topologies, network topologies, LIMPAC performance, qualifying for the top 500, power and cooling. And then he'll come, and in his mind, he is thinking of something like, this was the old system, and of course what he envisions in his mind is something nice and flashy. Then he comes along and says, oh, wait a minute, we can't forget storage. Give me what I have, just only more of it. And unfortunately, that nice Ferrari is going to run more, it's not going to run very well, because so many times, those old paradigms just simply don't scale to these size of systems. You know, sometimes they do, but many times they don't. Now, all of you in here presumably are system administrators. And so what I want to do is try to take a look at some of the system administration issues that you have to contend with. And one of the things, the focus of my presentation will be this morning. Now, whenever you do a talk on storage, you're supposed to go through and take a look at the history of where we've been. And this is sort of an uninteresting page. So what I've done is I went out in Google Images and got some pictures of some of these old systems just to kind of give us an idea of where we have come from to where we are going. Okay? Now, when I put these things on slides, since I don't have copyrights for these, I'm going to have to take the pretty pictures out, but you'll have the technical information in the slide set. Anyhow, how many of you have worked on a CDC 6? Okay, there's a few gray hairs around here. You know, this goes back a long ways. You know, look at this. Raw capacity, 205 megabytes. Wow. And a streaming data rate of about 2 megabytes per second. If we go to another generation, this is what I cut my teeth on, actually slightly earlier model of this particular thing. This is the IBM 3380. We had a couple spindles. We had 1.2 gigabytes per second. 1.2 gigabytes of total capacity with 3 megabytes per second. And wow, we thought we had arrived. That was big. And it was big in terms of floor space. Then we come along another generation later, and along comes Seagate with these little these four and a half gigabyte internal drives, and you would rack up a whole pile of them. And you could get about 9 megabytes per second per drive. I actually have an old SSA storage system sitting in my office that's from this era that is still working very well. Capacity isn't very high, but the performance isn't too bad. And of course today, well this is actually 2008, the one terabyte SATA drives are now are readily being used out here. And are any of you using the 2 terabyte drives yet? Okay. Are they working well? You have to use them. Okay. Very good. And a streaming rate of 105 megabytes per second. You know, now that's a, you know, let's face it, that's a vendor number. That's not a number you're going to see in reality. Okay? Now, now you're the IT planning staff, and it is your job to, you guys are the ones that are supposed to take and put this thing together. The center manager comes out and buys all this stuff, and now it's your job to put it together and make it work. And this is what I want to take a look at. And what I want to go through are some scenarios. These are things that I have bumped in as I, since I work for a vendor. The first thing I do is when a customer is trying to look at building one of these storage systems, I try to figure out what they're doing and what they want to do and where they're going. And these are some scenarios that I've changed just a little bit so I don't identify, you know, any particular customer. But we have supposedly, you know, Juan, my manager told me I had to pick various unique names, tells me he has about 64 Linux nodes with a SAN-attached storage. That means just basically the storage is mounted on every node in their small cluster. They have 25 terabytes with a mixture of fiber channel disks of various sizes. And he's going to be installing a new cluster that's going to be at 256 nodes with future upgrades to 512 nodes. A significant increase in compute power. And how many of you are going through similar things right now? You know, and floor space is another issue you're dealing with too with all of this kind of thing. And he's going to be looking at a raw capacity on his new thing of about 200 terabytes, but he has to get up to about a half petabyte. And as far as I'm concerned, once you're over half petabyte, you're in that petabyte range. So this is on the small side of this scale, but this is a very common kind of scenario. Another one, oops, I keep hitting the wrong button. Another common scenario is where we have, Sujin works at a variety, works on a variety of systems. They have a modest cluster of 128 Linux nodes with a clustered file system. They have several smaller clusters of 16 to 64 Linux or Windows nodes. So, you know, some department might have 16 nodes, another one will have 32 nodes, something like that. They have a few SMP systems with some SAN-attached storage as well. And they have a mixture of fiber channels, SAS and SATA, adding up to about 250 terabytes. And now they've been asked to consolidate and expand the company's computer resources into a new system configured as a cluster with 512 nodes with upgrades to about 1,000 nodes in the near future. They will no longer have SMP systems in their shop. And their raw disk capacity will probably start out about a half petabyte, and that's a mistake, that should be PB, half petabyte, increasing up to 1 petabyte. Again, very typical, and in universities, this is very common, where they say physics department, biology department, chemistry department, you've got to share your toys, you're going to put them together, they don't really want to share, but they have to, so they make these larger clusters where they're coordinating, and they're starting to build these much larger storage systems. Another common scenario, Lynn manages a small cluster with a large storage capacity. A very small number of nodes, 32 nodes, with a mixture of Linux, Windows, and actually, I forgot to put it on there, but even Mac OS. They have three classes of storage, 75 terabytes of fiber channel, 360 terabytes of SATA disk, and a tape archive approaching 1 petabyte. The Lynn's new system will double every 18 months for about the next 5 years with similar usage patterns. So with the next upgrade, Lynn's storage system must be more easily accessible to other departments and vice versa. Currently, files are exchanged via FTP, S-copy, and are exchanging tape cartridges, and one department has a cluster consisting of 256 Linux nodes. So this is kind of a remote group, but this group, they'll have a small number of nodes, but a large amount of data. This is common, for instance, in digital media. And then I had one customer, it was really beautiful. Every time they needed more disk, they went down to Best Buy and brought home another box of disks. And we're saying, guys, we can automate this. So this expansion is catching a lot of people off guard. On a scenario that isn't very common, but does happen once in a while, this is a system that I recently worked on. They just had a small cluster of 256 nodes with about 70 terabytes of data, most of it with NFS, and I think they were using Lustre or something, if I recall correctly, on the other thing. And then they got a new cluster of much larger. It's actually 4,000 nodes. And they had to have a storage capacity of 5 petabytes. And they had applications all over the map, from everything from the millions of small files that the computational biologists loved to, you know, physicists crashing universes together in simulations, you know, with large files and this kind of stuff. And so we had to come up with a storage system that could accommodate this very large variance of application profiles. How many of these situations sound familiar to you all out there? Okay, quite a few. I'm having a hard time. The lights are pretty bright. But what you get from this is lots of different questions. And one of the things, and the thing that I want to focus on are some of these questions. Because when I come in as a vendor to take a look and discuss with you your needs and what kind of storage you want, a lot of people have no idea. When I ask them, what is your I/O profile? I'll get a blank stare. They can't tell me if they're using big files or small files. Sometimes they do. They say, well, you've got to talk to the programmers, things like that. You know, another thing that's also very keen is how can I control cost? Or how do I configure this system? You know, I mean, this is a lot bigger than anything I've ever had before. How am I going to configure it? And what kind of networks do I need? And can I extend my current solution, or do I need to start with a whole new design? That's a very difficult situation. I remember one time walking in, and a customer was using NFS everywhere, and clearly they had bottlenecks from it. And I was told by the sales team that, hey, they want to throw this thing out and start over. What nobody told me was the architect for the system was in the audience when I was making my presentation. And, of course, I thoroughly offended him when I told him his solution didn't work. I didn't mean to be personal, but many times people are very committed to that. And sometimes just the cost of changing your programming paradigm to accommodate this is very difficult. So what they wanted us to do is come up with a file system that would, you know, work with, quite frankly, poorly designed I/O, you know, at least at that scale. Given the rate of growth in storage systems, how should you plan for future upgrades? That's always is a real pain. And what is the trade-off between capacity and performance? That's a tough one. SATA versus fiber channel, things like that. Should you use NFS or SIFS, or do I need specialized file systems? And on this question, how many of you out there actually use Windows in your systems? How many of you are using some variant of Unix or Linux? Yeah, most of you. Okay. Windows is coming into its own, and I know that I have recently started putting things in. I'll confess right now, I'm a Unix bigot. And every time I get on my wife's computer, and when she had a PC, she quit asking me for help. She asked my son because I kept threatening to install Linux on it. And now she got a Mac, so everybody's happy, except my youngest son. He still likes PCs. Anyhow, what are the performance issues imposed by a petabyte-sized file system? You got to take a look at streaming rates, what I call IOP rates. Oh, and metadata management. When you get these file systems that are good, storage systems that are good at streaming large blocks of data, how do you cope with the metadata transfers? Now, I've asked a lot of questions, and I do, like I say, a two-day tutorial on all this stuff, and there's no way that I'm going to combine 2 days of material into an hour and a half presentation. So part of my goal this morning is to help put forward the kinds of questions that you need to think about to come to grips with so that you can work with the vendors who you purchase these systems from to help design them, to manage them, to plan for them, and that kind of thing. Now, one of the most important things to do as a sysadmin is to understand your user profile. As a system administrator, you're in a unique position because every programmer thinks of this computer as all his own and has very little regard of how his code interacts with other people's code. This is especially true in universities, research departments, and things like this, where the physicists write code one way, the biologists write it another way, or if you might be in some profit and loss organization, what I call sometimes P&L, you know, you might have different departments using these things, or just different application suites. And so sometimes you are the peacemaker, the broker, who's trying to balance the competing needs of these systems. And so I'll ask them, and so you are the common point, but many times they don't understand the access profile. And so there's a number of things that go into it, like what kind of cache locality do you have? Is your cache locality, since you're all computer sysadmins, hopefully you understand some of these technical terms, but the working set is just that subset of the data that's currently active in cache. Do you display spatial locality? And what I mean by spatial locality is you start at the beginning, you go to the end, and you access each record once. Very typical in scientific and technical computing. Temporal locality is successive accesses are clustered in time. You'll visit the same record multiple times. For instance, like if you go to an ATM and you want to take your wife or your significant other out on a date and you want to see how much money you have in there. So you put your card in, it brings in that record that represents your worldly wealth. You say, how much money do I have? You extract it and you go out on your date. The minute that you sit there fumbling around at that computer screen on your ATM is an eternity on systems with nanosecond clock rates. So that record gets hit multiple times. That's an example of temporal locality. Watching a movie is spatial locality. What kind of locality do you have? Sometimes you have no good locality, which becomes very difficult. What is the optimum size of your working set? You know, if you have good spatial locality, you need a very small working set, which means on your servers you need a very small amount of memory. By contrast, good temporal locality often requires a larger working set. It has to stay in there long enough so that it can be used multiple times. A mistake that I see a lot of people make is they'll get a system that has good spatial locality, they'll get their storage servers, and they'll order 64 gigabytes of RAM for those servers when all they need is 6. You know, because the memory usage is very minimal if you have spatial locality. But if it's temporal, it depends, you know, temporal's all over the map as to how big that working set is. And the other thing you should also keep in mind is that generic file systems generally use the virtual memory of the computer as for their system cache. How many of you are familiar with VMTune? Have any of you played with that? A few of you? It's kind of black magic. You know, you get VMTune is a tool to help control how the system uses memory. And if you optimize it to do well, work well with your virtual memory for the file system, it tends to hurt CPU performance. If you get it going well for CPU performance, it tends to hurt file performance. And trying to find that sweet spot in the middle is very difficult. You know, good examples of these kinds of file systems are things like EXT3, JFS, JFS2, Riser, XFS, probably NTFS would also fit here as well, although I'm not as familiar with NTFS. Now, the next thing in that I/O profile is, what is your access pattern? What kind of access pattern do you have? Is it a streaming pattern? You know, you have large files and you're bringing in large blocks of data. You know, I work with one file system where, you know, setting the block size to 4 megabytes gives you just 5 gigabytes per second of performance on a controller. You know, very good performance. It's measured in bandwidth, megabytes per second, gigabytes per second, very common in the high performance computing world, scientific and technical applications and so forth. IOP processing, which means input-output process, is typically small transactions with very poor temporal and spatial locality. This is not the world of OLTP. This is more like what we see in the world of computational biology. Any of you in here working with computational biology? Yes, okay, a number of you. You know, this is where you have these small files, and they're randomly scattered all over the platters. And there's just no locality to be had. And so you have to have lots of seek arms to get any kind of performance. I usually like to use IOPs per second as my measure. And if you take a look in, you know, vendor-published performance numbers, you know, those marketing numbers that aren't real, they usually assume 4K transactions for these, although I tend to measure them in various sizes. Transaction processing, this is the world of OLTP, and you typically do this with databases and stuff, which are masters at finding locality where none exists, or it's very hard to find it. And so they're trying to get some kind of locality. Typically, a large cache helps this. I probably, since I work in scientific and technical computing, the weakest area in my background in computer science is databases, but it's a very different profile yet again. How many of you in the world of OLTP, you know, online transaction processing? Some of you? Yes. And when you start getting a petabyte of that kind of stuff, it becomes a real challenge. Now, another thing in your understanding is to how do you come to understand what your user profile is? You know, most environments have mixed access patterns. You know, you'll have some streaming, some small record stuff, you know, things in the middle. You know, one of the bad things to do is to put home directories on that in that file system where you have the streaming data. You know, that high performance, expensive disk, cost is no issue. You know, we need speed and everything. And if you have a system that is optimized for streaming and you put your home directories on there, every time they do ls minus l, they might as well go take a coffee break because it takes so long to return. So, you know, I would recommend, if you can, separating them. But here's the typical response from the sysadmin. Oh, but my users can't figure out which file system they're supposed to use. So they want to put them together. And that becomes a challenge. Now, the problem is that what I say is, you know, use your schedule. How many of you have job schedulers that you use? You know, you can set up your job schedulers where they put some parameters, say big file, small file, streaming, you know, pick some easy words and let that sit there and pick for them and put it where it is. And if they pick wrong, they will quickly learn where it needs to be. Of course, there's also these cases where the people start with reading millions of small files, aggregate them into a big file, so you need two file systems. And so it becomes a challenge, but if you can, I recommend segregating them. Another best practice, I recommend developing use cases and or representative benchmarks. When you want down and you're letting out an RFP, you know, one of the things that's very hard for me as a vendor is when I'm reading an RFP, you know, they tell me how big they want their data. They usually know that. What they can't tell me is, well, what's the measure of success? If I hit a certain data rate, is that good enough? What is it? And how do you establish that? And the thing I like to recommend is realistic use cases, you know, that represent what your workload does. Another thing is to develop a file size histogram. I had a customer tell me, oh, we have really bad, you know, really small files. The average size is 2K, and they had, you know, a petabyte of it. And I went in, and I designed the system, optimized for it, and we just kept missing our performance benchmark, but just slightly. And I finally, at the end of one night, just gave up, threw up my hands, said, I don't know, I'm tired, I'm out of here, I'll come back at it and look at it fresh in the morning. Sysadmin stayed up all night and played with the file system. I taught him how to use it and everything. And he changed the block sizes and other things, and we were home free. And the reason was, they had told me what their file size histogram was wrong. The average size was 4K, not 2K. And that made a huge difference, and that got us over that mark. So understanding your file sizes. Now, some file systems claim that it's not important. I don't believe it. You know, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. But, you know, try to come up with understanding what is your standard file system size. And another thing you want to do is to try to come up with your average file system performance and standard deviation. You know, go back to your statistics classes. You know, you can use, since you're sysadmins, I assume most of you are familiar with IOSTAT. You can grab data from that, integrate it, and generate, you know, means and standard deviations. And a colleague of mine that is now retired, a guy named John Watts, always used to design storage systems to have a peak data rate of 3 or 4 standard deviations above the mean. And what he found, this is just a heuristic, so I don't have any technical papers or anything that back this up, but what he found is that during most of the time, you know, the file system is below peak, but you get periods of high activity, especially like on Friday afternoon when everybody wants to submit jobs before the weekend. And at other times where you hit these heavy loads. And so you want to be able to do that. But sometimes people will say, well, we can go up to 10 gigabytes per second. But they only hit 10 gigabytes per second for 2 milliseconds out of the year. To design a system with that much storage bandwidth is way overkill, gold plating, to quote Barry Boehm. And so what I recommend is you try to say, you need to go above what that mean is, because you have these peaks and valleys. But you don't want to go excessively above them. And so this is just a rule of thumb if you can establish that mean and standard deviation. I have yet to find, ask a sysadmin who had a handle on that information. And I'm going to be making a presentation at another conference on tools. And one of my pleas to them is going to be develop a tool that will measure standard deviation conveniently for sysadmins, because that's a very useful piece of information for establishing what your data rates are. But remember, a lot of times people tell me, this is what I'm doing today. What do you see yourself doing a year from now, 2 years from now? And that's a much harder question to answer. Now, in trying to develop use cases, there's two ways you can do them. One is to come up with benchmarks based on real applications. This is probably the best way to do it. The Hennessy and Patterson textbook, his second edition, has got a good chapter on how to do this. And they're going to provide probably the best assessment of actual usage, but you've got to carefully select them, because how many of you have a uniform workload that's the same day in and day out? Well spoken. What you want to do is you want to go through and you need to pick up something that's representative, because if you tell me that's what you need, that's the system I'm going to build for you, you know, or any vendor. And so you need to come up with a representative model, but they can be difficult to use. Typically, they take longer to run. And how many of you can take your data and send it to a vendor site to put on a system someplace else? You know, some of you here are probably locally, you know, you work behind the black curtain, and you can't take your data out. So you have to work with your vendor to bring the data on site. Now, if you're buying a petabyte of storage, most vendors are probably going to be willing to loan you something to test it on, but it becomes more difficult. The other option is synthetic benchmarks. These are much easier to use, and the results published in white papers by the vendor typically are based on synthetic benchmarks. You know, the usual culprits being Bonnie++, IOR, IOZone, XDD, SpecFS, and in my case, I've written my own. I call IBM for IO benchmark. I strongly discourage against the use of IOZone, because sometimes the IOZone has basically some freshman programming errors in it in terms of how they calculate their statistics, which makes it very hard to be predictive. And if you want the style of benchmark that IOZone is, I'd recommend Bonnie++ over IOZone. Now, having said that, they may have fixed it, because I've made this comment in several other audiences, and I'm hoping that they get the word and that they will fix that. But last time I checked, which has been a while, they haven't. But when you do select benchmark codes, you need to do, if you're going to use a benchmark as opposed to a use case, what you want to do is find something that represents that correlates to your workload. A lot of customers will say, if you can use this benchmark at this and meet this objective, then it will be good enough for what I really do. Now, sometimes those correlations are at best tenuous. I mean, I happen to understand a little bit about statistics, and sometimes I don't see how they correlate, but that's the thing you want to do, is make sure that if you're going to use a synthetic benchmark, or even write one of your own. I have customers that sometimes write their own benchmark so that they can tune it to do what they want to do to reflect their workload. Just make sure it correlates well, so that if you buy the system and it really does meets that benchmark, it'll do well on your system. Now, the next thing is the cost versus capacity versus performance versus reliability. My former job, my third line manager said he always wants better, faster, cheaper. But there are cost trade-offs. You know, are you going to optimize streaming performance, IOP performance, capacity, cost, or reliability? And how much can you spend to get what you need? Now, one of my gripes is that the accountant should not be dictating technical policy. But, and it reminds me of a famous quote from Neil Armstrong. Just remember that all the mechanical parts in the Saturn V were made by the lowest bidder. Sometimes your accountants will say, this is, you know, you have to take the lowest bid. And but when I was actually, before I joined IBM, I was working in an oil company for a while. And I used to get so frustrated because the accountant said, you can only spend this much money. But I says, look, the features that I need aren't available at that cost. And that's just a tension that you got to work out internally. But again, you need to decide which of these are most important. Usually cost is number one on most people's lists. And then there's some one of these others that come after that. Now, when it gets down to this, they have what you know the industry calls enterprise disk. Today, that consisted of the 15K RPM fiber channel disk. By the way, whenever I refer to fiber channel, I mean the 15K RPM variety. And the same with SAS, the 15K RPM drives. The 10K RPM drives, they're still available, but very few people are using them anymore. And the common sizes are 146, 300, 450, and yes, 600s are on the horizon. Their mean time between failure is 1.4 million hours. Of course, that's just a statistical mile, a thing like your MPG ratings on a car. You know, this does not actually reflect real driving conditions, so it's something different, but it's something for comparison purposes. A single drive can, using 4K transactions can usually sustain 380 IOPS. A single drive streaming rate can usually hit RAIDs without cache enabled. 50 megabyte per second write rates, read rates of 95.4. By the way, these numbers here are measured by application. I'm not doing this through some kind of internal monitor, but anytime when I give performance numbers, if they're not marketing numbers, I will tell you, and what it is I have measured it by the application. So this is the numbers that you as a programmer would see. And so these reflect, you know, reality based on good programming. And as a best practice, these systems are usually configured using a RAID 3 or RAID 5 configuration, 4 plus P and 8 plus P being the most common variety. At the other extreme is the cost-optimized disk, SATA. You know, one of the sales team, somebody on a sales team I work with a lot, she likes to call it cheap and cheerful. Now, SATA, how many of you trust your data to SATA disk? How many of you do not? Okay, the tide is changing. If I'd asked this question 2 years ago, I'd probably had one hand come up for the first, you know, and everything. SATA is getting much better. Officially, the last MTBF number I've been able to find published is 0.7 million hours. I've heard 1 million hours, but I couldn't find that documented anywhere when I was preparing for this. I was looking through the technical specs from Hitachi and Seagate and stuff, and I couldn't find anything where they stated. They're using a new measure now called the annualized failure rate, and they call it 0.34%, and I'm not quite sure what that number really means. I tried to read it, and it's, you know, it's kind of like utilization, are you doing, 30% of the time, things like that. So it's a little hard to get my hands on, but usually the RPMs are 7,200. But the IOP rate is only 4K transactions is only 70, where the 15K RPM drives are capable of 380 IOPs per second. And if you can use the SCSI command tag queuing, which some vendors call NCQ, you can earn 20 IOPs per second. The streaming rates are also a little bit less. And as a best practice, we generally use RAID 6 with an 8 plus P plus Q or 8 plus 2P or 8 plus 2 or whatever you want to call it. But the point is you want to avoid the dual disk failure. That's the problem. You know, how many of you have experienced a legitimate dual disk failure in a RAID array? Several of you. How many of you are doing it with SATA? How many of you it happened with Fiber Channel? Okay. It doesn't happen very often, and it happens more frequently with SATA, but it's getting a lot better. And with the RAID 6 with two parity disks in a RAID group, the problems of losing data due to dual disk failures has drastically reduced. I don't have good statistics on it as to how much it is, but since I've started seeing people using 8 plus 2P, I've seen very few cases of it since that. And the point being is that SATA is often now good enough for most situations. And that's the purpose of this slide. You know, a lot will depend on how the storage controller manages your RAID, as to which one is best. And what I have found doing, and I just recently got back. I spent 3 weeks at our OEM partner for one of our storage products, benchmarking this, quite heavily on a new product. And what I found was that my streaming performance, if I had 240 SATA disks in the same 240 SATA disks behind the controller, or 128 fiber channel disks, 15K RPM variety, my peak streaming data rates were roughly the same. The 15K RPM drives were slightly faster, but not much. You know, the difference was, the read rates were, I think I got like roughly 5 gigabytes per second, and the other was 4.8, something like that. So it was very comparable. And also using RAID 6 levels the playing field because that eliminates that risk, significantly reduces the risk of dual disk failure problems that you've had with SATA in the past. Also, these RAID controllers, many of them now do things like, you know, parity check on read is what I like to call it. You know, before you had, the data was so dense, if you get a slight bit of head wobble and it starts tracking, it gets off the track a little bit, you know, square waves aren't square. When you come in, you can actually have undetected parity errors, and now most of the storage controllers provide checks for that. Now, there's some overhead with it and things, but again, they've done a lot to make SATA a lot safer to use. But the usable capacity for SATA is so much greater. You know, if you have 240 of these SATA disks, you have 192 terabytes, where with Fiber Channel, you'll have only 46 terabytes using the 450 gig drives. Obviously, with the 600 gig drives, that'll come up to about 60 terabytes, 55, 60 terabytes, somewhere in there. So, and the 2 terabyte, of course, will jump up to 384. So your capacity is a lot more, and you get the same streaming performance. The limitation is the IOP rate, because the IOP rates for SATA just isn't that good. So if you're the computational biologist with millions of small files, the Fiber Channel is still going to be better for you. They're going to be able to, you know, access, you know, move the seek arm more frequently with it. Now, I will tell you right now, I'm making a case for why you should use SATA over Fiber Channel. And then a few slides later, you're going to see where I'm going to make the complete opposite argument, okay? You know, it's one of those professor things that I used to like to do to keep my students honest. So you'll see me go both ways on this. But the problem is that there's no one answer to any of this stuff. And as sysadmins, this is something that you should realize. As programmers, we tend to see the world in, you know, through, you know, these pristine, beautiful, everything works, and the sysadmin knows that it doesn't. And that's the reality that you have to deal with as a sysadmin. Now, another thing to do in terms of managing the cost of your data storage is to remember that data has a life cycle just like software. You know, and what I like to talk, I have what, you know, my storage hierarchy, and you can get a more complex than this. You can have multiple storage tiers, a tier 1, 2, tier 2, tier 3, and tier 4. Tier 1 is the fast disk. When you want performance, this is the data that when you want data that is immediately there, it's being used a lot. This is the, you know, doing your immediate day-to-day processing. That's your scratch storage. Cost is less of an issue there because you need performance. Tier 2, you tend to focus more on cost-optimized storage. This typically turns out to be SATA disk, you know, the cheap and cheerful. This is the stuff you access less frequently. You know, the enterprise class, this is the stuff that stays hot for the next month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, whatever. And then it gets into a stage where that data has been created and it gets referenced once in a while for Q&A and stuff. And so performance just needs to be good enough. And so that you can move your data from this tier 1 to the tier 2, which is a little cheaper. And then if it hasn't been touched for 2 years, or if it's a graduate student, you put it on tape. And you leave your data out there on tape for however long. And if it has, in the robotic tape library. I mean, if you've got a petabyte of disk, your tape robots get to be very large. And your tape capacity. And then finally, after a few years, if it hasn't been touched, you move it to some offsite place in a salt dome or someplace where you can keep the data indefinitely. The only problem there, they have to periodically refresh those tapes because after 20 years, the magnetic media starts wearing out and things like that. So data has a lifespan. And what you want to do is manage the data for that lifespan. Now, towards the end of this talk, if there's some time, I'm going to go over some specific examples of how you can do this. Part of the problem is I don't have a lot of vendor-neutral information on that because this is something that's been coming more into its own recently, and I'll talk more of it if we have time at the end. Okay. Now, the other thing that you want to do is realistically assess your uptime and availability requirements. How many of you are familiar with the term 5-9s? How many of you in here have a 5-9s requirement? Okay. I had a customer come in and tell me one time that he had a 5-9s requirement, and the RFP said that we had 2 hours of downtime a year. That's 4-9s. Guy, I can save you 20%. This was a multi-million dollar purchase. I said, I can save you 20% by going down to 4-9s. Oh, no, we need 5-9s. Sales team was very happy. But take a realistic assessment of what your uptime requirements are. There are people, especially here in the Washington, D.C., Baltimore area, where 5-9s is very important. Weather forecasting is another thing, telephony applications, there's others where 5-9s is really important, but it adds a lot of cost. With 99.9% uptime, allows you 9 hours of downtime a year. How many of you in here who have a 5-9s requirement have more than 5 minutes of downtime in a year? Okay. Yeah, I see one hand go up. It's a tough standard, but the equipment that you need for it costs a lot more. Again, Barry Boehm, he's a professor of software engineering at UCLA, or before he retired, this is his last job, and he talks about gold plating, and this is one of the places where people put in a lot of gold plating, telling me they need uptime requirements that are beyond what's realistic or what they actually need. Now, another issue to worry about is guaranteed access to data. How many of you have that? I don't care what the weather's, if Hurricane Katrina takes out New Orleans, it doesn't mean that New Orleans doesn't have to predict the weather for tomorrow. And so we have this, if you need to have guaranteed access to data, military applications is another place where this happens, then we need to come down and you need to think, first of all, if this is a requirement, is access to all of your data necessary? I had one customer that said, no, what we have is about 20% of our data that we have to have access to at all times. So they split their data center between two geographically distant places so that they had access to that essential 20%. Saved them a lot of dollars. And is immediate access to that data necessary? Do you need it like right now regardless? Or, wait a minute, if I get it back the next day, it's good enough. These are some questions that you need to consider when you're looking about guaranteed access. And as I've stated already, setting this artificially high can unnecessarily increase cost. So take a serious look at that. Another issue is, I have a half petabyte of disk. I don't want to throw it out. Can I reuse it? And that is an interesting question. How many of you are willing to throw out your current investment? No. Oh, I saw one hand back there. You must not like it. I was always willing to get rid of it when I at my former job because the previous manager purchased I didn't like. And so, sure, we'll throw it out. We'll get something new, and the accountants wouldn't let me. Anyhow, you want to preserve your investment. Can I save money doing it? And does the cost of reprovisioning the storage exceed its value? That's a very important question. Because what happens is people will have, especially if you're growing from something small to something large, they may have been working with NFS. It was good enough. And now you're starting to get a much larger cluster. And you're and your data rates and your queuing contention and all that stuff becomes a lot more significant. And if you stick with that old technology, in fact, this example I mentioned a minute ago where the customer, they would go down to Best Buy every time they needed more disk. Well, they've been doing it that way for the last 20 years, except it wasn't Best Buy back then. You know, what they were doing is they got locked into the system, the software is hard to change, and finally they got a new manager that says, I don't care, we're changing it, and they're throwing the whole thing out and putting in, you know, one rack that'll have all the disk they need. You know, if you get into the situation, you've got to take a look at, if I keep this old technology around, am I going to be forced into using arcane programming principles? Not always. A lot of times you can reprovision it just fine. And many file systems can accommodate it quite well, and there are also third-party products that can actually manage different stuff. You know, an IBM product called SVC, I don't know if any of you use it, but it can come through and you can put EMC Clarion, you can put, you know, our old SSA disk, you can take LSI and DDN, you can all put it under there and present it as one storage system through this thing. So there are products that will help you to do that, but then there's performance issues of mixing and matching. You know, if you're trying to optimize performance, you've got a mixture of slow disk and fast disk in the same system, guess what, you're not going to go any faster than your slowest disk. So these are issues that you've got to sort out when you're trying to reprovision technology, your disk technology. Now, another thing that I try to do when I sit down with a customer, when I start trying to assess their storage requirements, what I want to come up with is a set of building blocks, a single building block that represents the smallest unit of servers and disk. And then from there, I will replicate that building block multiple times. Today in storage, I mean, how many of you are seeing, you know, exponential growth in your storage requirements, or what looks like exponential growth? Yeah, a number of you. I mean, right now it's very common where people say, well, I'm going to buy a half petabyte today, but I expect in a year from now to be up to 2 petabytes, and after that 4 petabytes. And when you calculate the rate at which they're creating data, I mean, 10 petabyte sized file systems are just, I mean, I'm sure there's some now in production, or are starting to come in. So this data rates are growing significantly. And so you have to go in, and what I like to do is design the system with building blocks so that you can come in and say, oh, here's a building block, let me get another building block, and we will keep adding more building blocks as I go along. And that allows you a way to grow. It's kind of as a build as you grow approach. Now, these work best for land-based file systems. It doesn't work as well with a SAN-based file system. And the other thing that we're starting to see is that the building block units, you know, the storage controllers, are getting to be very large building, are forcing into very large building blocks, given the cost. And, you know, you got a 5 gigabyte system that takes 128 disks to saturate it. You're starting to get into fairly expensive systems, and the building blocks aren't very small. But if you find storage controllers that allow you to have small building blocks, you get such a large number of components, guess what happens to your mean time between failure? It's proportional to the number of components that you have. And so, you know, they sometimes, small building blocks gives you better cost scaling, but then again, they have, you know, reliability issues that you have to manage. And I want to take a closer look at a little bit of this. Now, one of the other things I'm going to tell you is that when I do design a building block, I always try to look for a balanced building block. You know, I want the peak performance of the controller to be matched with the right number of disks that will match that performance. So on one particular unit that I work with a lot, 128 fiber channel disks will match its peak performance. Another one, it takes 160. You know, 300 SATA, another one with 240 SATA. So I'll put in the number of disks necessary to keep it balanced. Then, you know, there's no point in putting an engine for a D9 dozer in a little small compact car. Or what's the bigger problem is I'll have somebody that takes this one little server that's good for maybe a gigabyte per second of aggregate bandwidth, but the spinning disk has a potential of 5 gigabytes per second, and he's wondering why he's not feeding his data. So you want to pick the number of servers, controllers, and things so that you get balanced. But as a colleague of mine in IBM likes to explain, you can't always do that. You know, performance is inversely proportional to capacity. Many times, you'll have huge capacity requirements, but performance isn't a big issue. So by the time you get the capacity you need, you have a bandwidth that exceeds anything you might need, but then again, you have to get the capacity. The other problem that I have, a lot of, especially with the national labs where they're providing systems for people, researchers to come in and use, they don't need very much capacity because they're supposed to get rid of that data and move it someplace after they get done with their project. But to meet the performance requirement, I have to give them so many spinning disks that exceeds their capacity. So sometimes hitting this balance goal you can't always do that. But with that in mind, and when you get the slides, you're going to have these examples, and I'm not going to go through every one of them in detail. But the idea is I try to come up with this building block, and here, from a marketing perspective, this is a 6 gigabyte per second building block. I can come in and I can put in five drawers of disk, put 32 disks in each one of the 15K RPM variety, and I can generate actually about 5 gigabyte per second, a little over, I think 5.6, yeah, it's about 5.6 gigabytes per second. You'll notice here that I have four storage servers. Each of them have a dual port 10 gigabit ether thing. 10 gigabit ether measured by the application is good for 700 to 725 megabytes per second. Yeah, I can put one task on one node and push it up a lot higher. But by the time you start getting file system overhead and everything that goes over it, I amortize out about 725 megabytes per second for a 10 gigabit ether connection. And so call it 700, that gives me 5.6 gigabytes per second across the servers. And the storage controller is good for about 6 gigabytes per second. You'll see that I'm coming in with dual port 8 gigabit fiber channel adapters. And each one of those I can push to about 1560. So I'm coming in with roughly 1500, going out with at most about 1500, give or take. And what I have here is a balanced building block, optimized for performance. I'm using a small number of 15K RPM disks. At the other side, and this is just where, okay, I've put together a couple building blocks, and you'll notice here I just showed two frames, but if I want to scale out to a petabyte, I will need 14 of these building blocks to scale out to a petabyte. And this is optimized for performance, and this system will give me 78 gigabytes per second. Now, for a lot of people, you don't need that much bandwidth. So somebody's laughing. Okay, I like you. Anybody that needs lots of bandwidth, give me a talk. I'll put my sales shirt back on, and then we'll come talk. Anyhow, in this case, I'm using IB, InfiniBand. I'm using the DDR, 4X DDR variety. QDR is coming on. I just haven't had a chance to benchmark the QDR stuff with the file system yet. But anyhow, this is good for about 1,500 megabytes per second if you get your tuning right. Oh, one warning. Sometimes when you're using dual port 10 gigabit ether, getting your channel bonding correct is a pain. I had a cluster of 4,000 nodes, and all the MACs had an even address. And so I only used half of them. I could see who the network people are in the room because they understand the joke, and it wasn't a joke. I mean, I said, what's going on? I'm only getting half of my bandwidth, and trying to find out where it went was a pain. And finally, somebody said, but the MAC addresses are even. And then, boom, light dawns. Anyhow, that's one of the reasons I like IB, because I can get more with a single link. Although IB is overkill in many cases. Anyhow, a similar situation. This, again, is about 5.6 gigabyte per second solution. And this time I'm using 300 SATA disks of the 1 terabyte variety. So I have 300 terabytes here. And so if I go to my multiple building blocks, what I end up with is I only need 4 building blocks to hit the petabyte range. But I'm focused here on capacity. The performance here is 22 gigabytes per second. The other one, I had 14 building blocks, same capacity, but the bandwidth was 78 gigabytes per second. Now remember I said I was going to be talking against myself a while ago where I said SATA is good enough, and here I'm saying it isn't good enough. It depends really what your performance requirements are. And this, by the way, might be good enough for streaming performance, but if you're a computational biologist or some other application that uses the millions of small files, then you probably want the 15K RPM disks just to get enough seek heads moving. So scaling, these building blocks allow you a very convenient way of scaling out your system. But you've got to take a look at these. And by the way, this is sort of a balance between capacity and performance. The next example I give you here where it is purely capacity. You want 1 petabyte, I can put it behind a DDN S2A 9900 couplet, and I can put 1.2 petabytes of raw, 960 terabytes usable capacity, give it 4 servers, and I've got a 5 gigabyte solution to a petabyte of data. But is the capacity to performance ratio right for your application? If you're needing to stream through lots of different data, you might need more controllers. You see, in the previous example, if I go back, let me go back here. In this case, you'll notice that I have only 5 trays of disks, so I have twice as many servers. And actually, if I went up to 4 building blocks, I'd have this 4 of them, so I'd have 16 servers, 4 couplets, 20 disks of drawers spread over 4 different units, giving me higher bandwidth. Where in this case, I've put it all behind a single controller and behind 4 servers. So, you know, sometimes when you're going through and you're trying to save cost, your sales team is going to offer you this. And I'm forever and a day having to fight with the sales teams and the customers saying, hey, wait a minute, you need performance. This is cheaper, but if you want to, you know, there, I don't know how many times I've walked into a cluster and see it getting about 30%, 40% utilization because it is starved for data, because they put this behind, they don't have enough servers and enough controller bandwidth to harvest the bandwidth potential of the spinning disks. So this is something that you've got to balance out in your whole cost thing. And sometimes, you know, we have customers that, you know, want the Cadillac solution, but they only have a cheap compact budget. And I don't know, that. And I said, that's the sales team's headache. That's not mine. I'm a geek. Okay. Now, this is just another case of where I'm scaling this out a little bit more. And I'm going to skip over these examples. Oh, common mistake. A lot of times, I have a customer who will come through and they'll put together a system that has, let's say, 600 SATA disks or 1,200 fiber channel disks. And guess what? Their capacity here is roughly the same, 540 terabytes for over 1,200 fiber channel disks, 600 terabytes for SATA. Capacity is the same, and in this particular case, the performance will be the same. So once your capacity to performance ratio hits a certain amount, SATA will actually meet your performance criteria, assuming that IOP rate is not the issue. If IOP rate is the issue, then you need the SATA. Although in this particular unit, your IOP rate will probably get clipped at about 40,000, and so you'd need another controller. So these are some of the things that you've got to balance out as you're working through this. Okay. The next examples, I'm going to skip over them, but they're just using smaller building blocks, the same story. But the moral of that story is be careful when you put together lots of small building blocks, especially when you're using SATA, because you will have more RAID rebuilds going on when you're using SATA disk. And if you have one file system spanning a petabyte of over a lot of different controllers, one of the things that I've learned kind of through the school of hard knocks is that there's always some RAID array rebuilding when you get a petabyte. And if you always have some RAID array rebuilding and your performance rate goes down because of it, your performance will be hindered by those RAID rebuilds. So you've got to be careful about that. Now, if you build it with multiple file systems, then that eliminates that risk. So if you have say, 16 of these small building blocks and you have 16 different file systems, then on any given time, you're probably rebuilding one of the file systems. But if you have one file system spanning all of them, your file system will be constantly impeded by the RAID rebuild. And so be careful when you start putting together large amounts of SATA. Now, some storage controllers have very good drive side bandwidth, lots of drive side connections, so that they can maintain full bandwidth during a RAID rebuild. So there are other solutions, but again, that gets into the bigger building blocks. The smaller building blocks will be cheaper, they're less expensive to make, and you can put a lot of these cheap ones in there, but if you build one file system across them, be prepared to manage the risk. Okay? It's not that that you can't do it or that you shouldn't do it. Just understand what your risks are and manage them accordingly. Okay, I'm going to skip the next few slides here because I just kind of talked you through this. And, oh, the other thing of build as you, just like I used to be, how many of you are using SAN file systems? How many nodes do you have on your SAN file systems, roughly? Anybody have over 256 nodes on your SAN file system? Okay, the largest SAN file systems I know in production today are 256. Had somebody went down, they bought four frames of an IBM product we call iDataPlex, had 384 nodes in it, and the file system was falling to pieces because nobody's built a SAN that big before. And I say, look, that needs to be a LAN file system, you know. And the issue is cost. They had to have a very short queue depth and other things like that. So when you build like you did before, if you're using a SAN file system, be careful how big you build your SAN. Now, different SAN file systems have different scales, and I'm reticent to say how big they can do because every time I say this is the biggest it can go, somebody says, oh, we've made it bigger. And I say, well, give me an example. Well, I can't, but generally speaking, if you need thousands of nodes, you don't want a SAN file system. Okay, so if the number of nodes are going to scale very large, be careful about using your SANs. Okay, now, another issue that's a fairly controversial issue sometimes is, in terms of performance, is ease of use versus flexibility. One of the things that a lot of customers like about NAS solutions is it's a black box. You plug it in, hook it up, turn it on, and walk away and forget about it. And NFS always works. Yeah, right. Anybody believes that, I'll go sell them that bridge out there. Okay, but there's no doubt about it. NAS appliances tend to be an easier solution to use. And if your applications work well with the cache assumptions of the NAS, you can get very good performance from it. But that's many times not the case. If you get a more general purpose file system, one of the beauties of a general purpose file system is they generally have a lot more tunables. One that I work with a lot, I like to say one of its problems is it gives you a million knobs to turn. It's one of its salient features, but one of its problems is it has a million knobs to turn. And you got to learn to turn them. Now, actually, you just have to learn to turn the few that you need. But file systems that have lots of tunables, while they might be a little more difficult to use, will allow you to tune them to meet the specific needs. I know a lot of people are using NAS because, well, they started out with NFS and NAS was just an easy way to go. But they can't really tune them as well to meet the particular needs. So it's the black box versus white box issue. And in my former job where I was the lead systems programmer, I had a team of about 15 programmers working for me. And we were stealing a lot of people from our competitor because we had better management than they did. So they all couldn't wait to get an offer from us. But they said, but we liked their software better because it was a black box and they didn't have to worry about it. But if they didn't like the bandpass filter that box gave them, they were stuck with it. Where we said, here's 15 different ways you can tune your bandpass filter. It made it more complex, but we could deal with more complex geology, it was an oil company, than the competition could. So, you know, flexibility has its good points and it has its bad points. Oh, my next thing is, this next slide is what I call seek arm mechanics. And there's just basically one takeaway from this slide. Every time you move that seek arm, move as much data as you can. Because, you know, performance is dominated by seek arm movement. you know, on a SATA disk, your average seek time is 9 seconds. On a 15K RPM disk, it's about 3.6 seconds based on Seagate, recent Seagate drive specs that I could find. And what happens is when you have the millions of small files scattered all over the platters, and every time you move that seek head, you move it, you pick up a 4K chunk of data, and you move again, you're having to amortize an awful lot of, a small amount of data over an awful lot of time. Whereas if you can park that head, take up the whole, read the whole track before you move it again, you get much better performance. And by the way, if you use if you use your disk drives like tape drives, you know, without a file system and stuff, you can get really good performance out of them. But if you start putting a file system on them, and you get this other thing I like to call disk entropy, if you delete and replace and delete and replace, over time your files become randomly distributed, even if you tell them to keep them contiguous. And that increases your latency and hurts your performance on these systems. Okay, the other thing you want to do when you start building petabyte-sized storage systems is to avoid single points of failure. The problem is, as you start getting to petabyte-sized file systems, you're getting bigger clusters, and you have lots of moving parts. And so if we take the traditional NFS solution, you've got this particular unit that's capable of about 6 gigabytes per second marketing number. I put on it 4 NFS servers. So I've taken its disks, I've partitioned it up into 4 separate file systems, so I have a set of NFS exports from each one of these servers. If one of those servers goes down, you get what I call the NFS blank stare. The system is not responding because that single point of failure, that NFS server, just went down. So what you can do is you can come through and say, well, wait a minute, let me avoid that. And I'm going to come through here and I'm going to put together some kind of a clustered file system so that I have redundant storage servers. So if this one dies, this guy can pick up for the one that just died. And so I can lose any one of my storage servers, but I don't lose access to my data. A little bit of performance. And if I need to have a quality of service guaranteed, in other words, guaranteed that I can hit the same peak rate, then I just have to have redundant, twice as many servers. But right here, I have access to my data. However, I still have a single LAN switch. So I have some customers that what they will do is they'll put in multiple LAN switches. And I forgot to put on here a two-way aggregated channel for each one of those things, so that you can lose one of your gigabit ether adapters, and the other one can still pick up for you. Now, as you move across this scale, it gets a little more expensive because you're adding increased redundancy to avoid these single points of failure. But when you start getting in large systems, your risk exposure related to single point of failure becomes increased. Now, the other thing is tools to manage storage. How many of you are happy with all the tools that you have to manage your storage? No hands. I wonder why. This is what the storage toolbox looks like for the sysadmin. There are not very many tools out there. There are some. Each of the vendors will provide certain tools with their products, but you don't have one tool that can come through and just give you a complete picture of your storage system, give you the standard deviation, the mean, your access patterns, your performance, your seek rate. Your latency. How many of you have a way of measuring latency on your file system? There are tools out there that do that, talk about it afterwards. I'll put my IBM shirt back on, I'll tell you about it. But the fact of the matter is that these tools are woefully inadequate. Now, the primary tools that you have are benchmarking tools, system monitors, things like Ganglia, IOSTAT, NMON, VMSTAT, that'll help you. One of the things that's really hard is just finding out when the network breaks down. You know, I remember I was sitting over here, I was setting up a benchmark, and I was getting about 80 megabytes per second on a system 80 megabytes per second on a system capable of 2 gigabytes per second. And I say, you've routed me through a gigabit ether somewhere. They say, everybody blames the network. It's not the network. And I didn't have any tool to prove my point, but I knew it was. And finally, 2 days later, he came with his tail between his legs, apologized, and said he had the routing tables wrong. Everybody blames the file system. Okay. Then you have storage controllers, and they usually provide management and monitoring tools, and then file systems, which is probably the main tool that you have to manage your storage as a sysadmin. Now, I'm down to about 5 minutes, and I need more than 5 minutes to cover the next few slides, so I'm just going to talk about them in general terms here. What I have here is a file system taxonomy that I keep threatening to publish, and when I get invited to this, it's, okay, here, I'll do it. Here it is. And I work primarily in the world of clusters today, and this is a taxonomy of clustered file systems, and the question is what are the different kinds of clustered file systems out here? In these slides, and when you go back and read them at your leisure, the purpose here is not to sell an IBM product, but merely to classify and to understand the different file system semantics, what they offer, what they don't offer. I make no guarantee that I'm 100% accurate in what I've got here. I know I referee a lot of papers, and every time somebody's comparing their product to another IBM products, I have to cringe because a lot of times they get it wrong. And you know what? I probably do the same thing too. And by the way, I've never rejected a paper for that reason yet. But I usually say, check your documentation and make sure your points are accurate. So I've tried to be as accurate as I know how, but I don't have the latest details on all of them. But starting at the bottom of the list is what I call the conventional file system. This is the shrink wrap, out-of-the-box file system that everybody has to have. NTFS, EXT3, JFS, Riser, XFS, you name it. They're journaled, extent-based semantics. They use VM virtual memory for their cache. Any of you do asynchronous I/O out here? Very few? Yeah, there's some. Asynchronous I/O has been kind of the unwanted orphan. Linux now supports it, though I've never really kicked the tires on it real hard. It doesn't seem to get as much attention as it used to, but it's built on top of other file systems typically. The next one is what I call network file systems, i.e. NFS and SIFS, and I'm sure every one of you are familiar with that. It's the bane of my existence, and it's not that there's any problem with NFS. The problem is people are trying to use NFS in ways it was never designed to be used. And let's see, NFS version 3 is going to fix all the problems of NFS version 2. See, NFS version 4, which is just now coming out, is supposed to fix all the problems of NFS version 3. See, parallel NFS is supposed to fix all the problems of NFS version 4. Do you see a pattern here? I am not an NFS fan, but if you use it properly, it can be a good tool, and sometimes it can be good enough. I have a customer that has 20,000 nodes in their center, and they use NFS basically for the stat data, and then they have their own underneath layer to do other things. But for that system, it's good enough. Other times, it isn't. The next level on my hierarchy, this is just showing a picture of NFS. The problem is a single point of failure, and it also becomes a bottleneck. The next level up, of course, is the appliances. NetApp has kind of defined that market probably better than anybody else, and they've got a good product. And if your product matches, if your application workload matches their caching assumptions, you'll get absolutely great performance for it. If you don't, then if it actually has to spin disk, then it doesn't do as well. Another product that is just starting to come on the scene is something called scale-out file services, which is intended to be able to scale out past single file heads. Then you get to the basic clustered file systems. I kind of call these the common component architecture. GPFS, GFS from Sistina, iBrix, I think. I've been having a hard time getting good information on iBrix. I'm going more by what customers tell me it does than what I've been able to find firsthand. But I think it fits here pretty much. The standard sort of configuration is that it's a LAN-based file system. You'll have some dedicated file servers, but this has more to do with economics than the technology of the software because file servers are expensive. So you have some dedicated file servers, but protocol is distributed across the cluster. You don't have a concentration of protocol like you do with NFS. Next level up is the SAN file systems. CXFS from SGI, SNF, you know, Store Next File System from Quantum, I think QFS from Sun are all good examples of SAN file systems. This is good for what I call the herd of elephants configuration, a small number of big nodes, where the other one, a LAN file system, is good for the army of ants, a lot of small systems. And this is just, again, one of their limitations, but again, for a small number of nodes, it's not a big issue. They've got centralized metadata servers. The next one I call the multi-component file systems. I also call it TWAIN, technology without an interesting name. This is basically Lustre and Panasis. Very good products. And so this again, it's another level on that hierarchy. And then you have MPIIO. How many of you have used MPIIO? Some of you? Again, that's trying to create a standard for it, and I can say if you have questions, you can ask me afterwards. And which one of these file systems is best? Sure, I know one that's best, but then I get a paycheck from this three-letter company. No, seriously, it depends on what you're doing. You need to take time and to thoroughly analyze your use cases, your applications and stuff, and pick the best tool to meet your needs. And by the way, don't forget tape. Tape is not dead. There's an awful lot of bandwidth in a pickup load of magnetic tape. Or I had a gun customer and had to move about 200 terabytes of data. They didn't have enough tape drives, so they loaded all their disk on a DHL flight and flew it over here. Great bandwidth, lousy latency. Okay, risk is inevitable. Manage it. And I appreciate your, you've been a delightful audience. Time for questions and answers. I'm going to come down here because I don't have to push buttons to keep the slides going forward. Go ahead.
I'm curious if you've played at all with Gluster. They're one of the new guys. They have a sort of, they have a couple different models where you can build a traditional file system, yeah, and they put it in Fuse on the client, which is good and bad. It's it's good in that you don't have to yet add another device driver or kernel module or whatever your client. It's bad in that it's Fuse. So can suffer from performance.
I've not played with it. You're the second person who's asked me about it, and it's one of those things for me to look up between midnight and 6 a.m. when I'm not doing anything else. Sorry, I don't know. Anything I have would be uninformed speculation.
It's pretty easy to install, and you can install it on just a cluster of machines and set up in peer-to-peer sort of scratch file system. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where we're looking at using it.
And yeah.
It's reliable, it's fast.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Well, if you have a few minutes after this presentation, I'd be delighted to talk with you a little bit more about it, because I'd like to learn about it. It's something on my to-do list. I just haven't gotten there yet. Other questions?
Yeah, just a quick one. So what are your thoughts on some of these vendors that are trying to make these so-called midline SAS drives?
Oh, boy. I had a knockdown dragout with one of our OEM vendors on that. I have to be careful because a lot of what I have is under non-disclosure. It's inevitable. It's coming. There right now, the other issue which I didn't touch on was SSD. And the models as we're moving forward, we're right now in a period of a very rapid flux. I think fiber channel, I think we're about the last generation of fiber channel disks when the 600s come out. Okay? This is not an IBM answer. This is just me just looking at, reading on Google, talking to people, and what have you. And SAS, and there's going to be two different levels of SAS. The big deal that they want is mechanically, the difference between SAS, today's the high-end SAS, or the 15K RPM and the SATA, besides the protocols that you use with them, is also the mechanics of the device. And there's no doubt about it that some people want cheap and cheerful. And the market is largely going that way. And the controller vendors are trying to manage that, and they're doing a much better job of it than they used to. But there are a lot of people, I mean, I saw a lot of hands up here, people still won't trust their data to fiber channel, I mean, to SATA. And so what's going to end up happening is that we're still going to have this two levels of mechanical quality in the devices and two performance levels. And then SSD now is starting to come into that play as well. And that's kind of where I see the market going. And again, there's very strong marketing pressure to go this way. So that's where I think it's going, and I think it'll ultimately be reliable because people aren't going to pay for it if it doesn't do what it's supposed to. Yes?
What do you think are the next big challenges in building large file systems, large data storage systems?
That's the first time anybody's ever asked me that question. The challenge is going to be managing the numbers of moving parts and the tools to do it. You know, again, without non-disclosure, I can't go into some of the projects I'm working on, but just let me say they're going to be, I'm from Texas and they're Texas big. And they wanted them cheap. And trying to manage cheapness with file systems of this magnitude are just, I think it's going to be a real challenge. You know, the question is, the storage controller vendors are actually doing a good job of managing disk. But there are people who say, let's throw away the storage controllers and let the file system take care of it. Where I used to work in my previous job, we had 2,000 SP nodes. And we had internal SCSI, and we spread our parallel file system over the internal SCSIs. And sysadmins would be jumping over desks every time a system went down to get it back up. Managing that much small disk is difficult. The biggest issues are going to be dealing with, I think, you know, how do we effectively use SSD? What is the best models for that? And what we need for the world of OLTP and a small office system is drastically different than what you need in the petabyte-sized file systems. What I want are cheap devices that I can plug into a controller that can manage my metadata or a small cache of frequently used data. I think these are some of the challenges that I see coming on, but we're coming into a period of, I think, rapid flux. And if you get a non-disclosure agreement, I can go into more details on it. Yes?
With data integrity, like T10 diff checksumming?
I've never really worried about that. There's about how many pages in the manual I have to read, and that was the page I haven't read yet. The data integrity, what I will say is that, you know, the RAID protections actually does a pretty good job. One of the big issues was the undetected RAID errors that were a real problem that was affecting some of these petabyte. You know, I had some customers a few years ago putting together petabyte-sized file systems using SATA, and I just said, don't do it. It's not ready yet. They did it, and it wasn't ready. But we're getting largely past that with the RAID. I don't know if that's the sense of your question, but I think from that standpoint. Now, the other issue is some of the bit error rates when we start hitting the really high data rates that are coming on the near horizon. Right now, a number that is widely published I can quote to you is 136 gigabytes per second, and catching errors at 136 gigabytes per second is a pain in the neck. We will have storage systems in the near future that will be an order of magnitude higher. And catching those bit error rates are a very difficult issue. And most of the storage vendors are rising to the challenge, and we have some solutions designed to do it. But it's not going to be business as usual. So, yes, that becomes a problem mostly at the very high data rates. You know, how do you catch them at such high data rates and when you have such a large volume of data? And that's where it becomes an issue. This, on the T10 standard, I'm just not that familiar with that particular standard. Other questions? If not, I'll go and give a quiz. No. Thank you. You've been a delightful audience.